So last time, the last thing I wrote down on the sideboard was a sort of just a very quick and slightly messy argument as to why differentiation wasn't entirely straightforward for vectors, because if we tried to apply a vector to a vector, we ended up with something that wasn't geometric. So I wrote it down in the coordinate frame. And I made the comment that the term that kind of was the bad term that wasn't geometric was symmetric in terms of the indices. So that suggests that we may be able to define some sort of geometric derivation on tensors if we somehow include anti-symmetry. So today we'll look at one way of doing this, which is the exterior derivative, which is also associated with differential forms. Now, I've actually already sneakily sort of half slipped in this exterior derivative by the back door, because if you remember, I wrote a form, or the components of a form, as being a downstairs index for the components. And so these would be the components. And so this was a coordinate basis for the dual tangent space. So what have I written here? I've actually written D. So what do I actually mean by that D? Well, if it's a dual basis, what it means is that if I act on the vector basis, d by dx nu, by the one form or the covector dx mu, then I get zero unless mu and nu are the same. So that's what you kind of mean by a dual basis. And so notice that this is in fact just dx mu by dx nu. So that suggests that I can take sort of D of any function, because after all, the coordinates are really just functions. You know, X is constant. X is just a function, locally at least, on the manifold. So I could say, let me write down my df. So what do I mean by df as a covector? Well, a covector acts on a vector to give a number. And so I'm going to say that df has the property that if I contract it with any vector, then I just get T acting on F, which we, was what we introduced yesterday as defining a vector. So I have this notion now of a derivative of a function as being a covector. So again, in terms of intuition, what you should be thinking about is comparing it to grad f in standard vector calculus, or sort of thinking about this d as being sort of representative of some sort of normal to a set of planes where the planes are f equals constant. So that's how you should kind of think of this covector, df. It's sort of also got this dual interpretation in terms of like surfaces or being normal to surfaces. So this D is now geometric. But we're just sort of talking about taking the derivative of scalars, which is, you know, doesn't get us very far. So if we want to generalize, we can generalize this D. We have to introduce the notion of forms or anti-symmetric covariant tensors. So the idea is we're going to sort of take tensor products, always covariant, always covectors, but we're going to make them fully anti-symmetric. So I better just check the notation of curved and square brackets. You used it?
Seen it? I mentioned it, but remind me.
Okay. New blackboard called for. I'm just going to put it right at the top. This looks like the front one is now dry. If you want to take something that's fully anti-symmetric, what you do is you kind of take all possible combinations, all permutations of the indices, and then you weight it by plus or minus, depending on whether it's an even or an odd permutation. So, for example, AAB anti-symmetrized would be AAB minus ABA over 2. And then to symmetrize, it's the same thing, but without the minus sign. So it's just a useful shorthand, and you'll be seeing a lot of square brackets over the next half hour or so. Okay, so a P-form is a completely anti-symmetric covariant tensor, and we kind of build it up. By taking anti-symmetric products of vector of covectors. So we do this using what we call the wedge product, and for two covectors, A wedge B is A tensor B minus B tensor A. So that's kind of the simplest example of the wedge product, but in general, so this is now a two form. And in general, if A and B are P and Q forms. So simply saying how many indices do they have. I always forget the combinatorial factors here, but so from the perspective of components, what you do is just sandwich A and B together and then just anti-symmetrize like crazy on all the indices. Now, because A and B are already anti-symmetric, you know that any permutations of all of the indices that only act separately on the first P and the last Q, those are all going to be the same up to a sign. So that's why you've got these combinatorial factors there. And then the P plus Q is just to kind of cancel off with this one here. So this wedge product, it's not as simple as saying it's anti-commutative. It's obviously anti-commutative if you have two one forms, because A wedge B is minus B wedge A. But if you have this general P and Q form, if you imagine reversing the order of A and B, you've kind of got to shuffle all these indices from this, from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. So it kind of depends on the dimensionality of the forms. So this wedge is linear. But sort of not, it's obviously not commutative. And so what we find is that A wedge B, if A is a P form and B is a Q form, is minus one to the PQ B wedge A. So that's what you get when you shuffle all those indices past each other. You can see you get a minus sign each time you swap, because that's what happens with a permutation. So you get P minus signs from moving the A1 to AP, and then you get Q minus signs because each of them goes through an index of B. So we denote this bundle of forms just by a sort of capital lambda. So the P tells you what the rank of the form is, and the lambda is telling you it is a form. So P is called the rank. So one of the things that sort of, it should be obvious, but probably not until you stop to think about it, I can't just go on constructing forms of arbitrary many indices because I've only got a finite number of dimensions in the manifold. And once I reach that number of dimensions and I add another index and try to anti-symmetrize, two of those indices will always be the same. So so there's a finite number of P forms that we can have up to the dimensionality of the space. So we can kind of think of this as sort of A where J is zero. So that's kind of where this is coming from. We can't, if we cross something with itself, it gives us zero. So this kind of leads us to a different way of visualizing these forms as sort of being, say, a two form is kind of, you think of it as a little sort of area, some little tile. And so this sort of component, the two form, if it was xy, it would be a little tile in the xy plane, and the magnitude of that component would give you something to do with the area. So you see this wedge product is actually very closely related to the cross product in three dimensions, and we'll see how before we're done. So again, what I kind of want you to keep in mind there is intuition is the cross product from vector calculus. So even though we're doing a sort of a whole lot of stuff on curved manifolds, quite often you kind of can use and import all the stuff that you already know and feel comfortable with from standard vector calculus. So once we get up to P equals N, we can one of the things that we can do in general is ask how many independent components does a P form have? And you can sort of argue or kind of think about it. You know, it's sort of like the same as saying how many independent components does an anti-symmetric matrix have, and it's kind of N choose P in general for these P forms. But what that means is by the time you get to the N form, you're basically back to something that's unique. So it's unique up to a factor, and so an N form is something that multiplies epsilon AB, etc., A, B, C, D. So this is plus or minus one, and it depends whether it's an even or odd permutation of one to n. So it's something that's either plus or minus a number, depending on the sign of that you've chosen, you know, how you've chosen those indices. Strictly speaking, this isn't actually a tensor, this epsilon. So if I think about epsilon, you know, maybe I want to define a tensor an N form using that epsilon, the alternating symbol. It's not really, that doesn't give you quite the components of a tensor. It's more like a tensor density. And that's because if you think about what happens under a coordinate transformation, so suppose I tried to form a tensor, an N form, by taking the alternating symbol and just, you know, matching each leg with one of the basis one forms dx mu, then if I do a coordinate transformation, I get something that looks like the same object, 1 over n factorial, mopping up all the epsilon indices, but I get a Jacobian out front, because that's actually how you define the determinant of a matrix in arbitrary dimensions. You define it via these various permutations or combinations of of your matrix, which in this case is the coordinate transformation matrix. However, if I have a metric, I can make a covariant object. how do I do that? Well, I take the components of my metric and I take the determinant of that as a matrix. Then under a coordinate transformation, the determinant of my G primed goes like a determinant of G times the transformation, but of course, because I'm now taking the determinant, this is now just det G times det dx by dx prime squared. So if I take my det G, so here, if I sort of look at what's happening here, so this kind of goes to this, if I multiply this combination by a det g, you see that my det g is equal to, sorry, root det g. So root det g is equal to root det g prime divided by that Jacobian. And so it cancels off this term here. So with the metric, I can construct this covariant anti-symmetric tensor. And with a metric, I can also raise and lower indices. And what this does for me is actually provide a way of hopping from P forms to N minus P forms. Because if I have a P form, I can take my epsilon and use the inverse metric to kind of, you know, contract the P indices of the P form with the epsilon tensor, which leaves me with an N minus P anti-symmetric object. So this process is called dualizing or Hodge dual. And we denote it by a star. So our star maps P forms to N minus P forms. And in terms of components, we say that so A goes to star A, which is So that's how I construct this dual. So now that means I can kind of go back to a thought that I had here, saying that you know, A wedge B was rather like the cross product, because if I'm in three Cartesian dimensions, my metric's just like the Kronecker delta, so det G is one. So my epsilon symbol really is just my standard epsilon ijk. And so if I take A wedge B, that's a two form, but I can then dualize my two form back to a one form. So here, I see that the cross product is simply the Hodge dual of A wedge B. So that's just, I mean, that's sort of in three dimensions. The reason why we don't have an immediate intuition of two forms is because we meet vectors in three flat Euclidean dimensions. And so if we were to construct a two form, which would be a wedge product, it's much simpler to just write it as a vector using the dual, Hodge dual. So that's why we don't sort of immediately meet two forms. Now let's look at our exterior derivative. So it takes a P form and gives us a P plus one form. So we can think of our function as being a zero form, take D of the function, we get a one form. And so in general, if we have a one form, we expect D to give us a two form. Now mathematically, the axioms that D must satisfy is that D reduces to DF on functions, in other words, what we've already seen. D is sort of Leibnizian, it's almost Leibnizian. So usually when you're talking about defining a derivation, you want it to be Leibnizian. And so what the only sort of proviso is that if D is acting on A wedge B, then it first acts on A, so this would be like your beginning Leibniz bit. But then, rather than being dA times B plus A times dB, we have to allow for the fact that our D, the operator, has to pass through A, and A is a form. So it's almost Leibnizian, but up to minus signs. And then finally, we must also have D squared is zero. So a map, a derivation between lambda P and lambda P plus one that satisfies these requirements gives you, specifies, the exterior derivative. So if I write it in components, all I do is I take the partial derivative of A and then anti-symmetrize like crazy. So you can see how this gets around the problem of taking partial derivatives that we saw at the end of yesterday's lecture, because the bit that wasn't geometric was the second derivative of the coordinate transformation, which was symmetric. So this will kill that term. And so that's sort of, if you like, that's intuitively a reason why this is a geometric operator. So since I've also been talking about what happens if you've got a metric. So if you have a metric, you can also use the Hodge dual to kind of hop over from your P form to an n minus p form, take d of that to get an n minus p plus 1 form, and then you hop back by dualizing to get a p minus 1 form. So we call this delta, if you like, so that's star d star, which maps p forms to p minus 1 forms. And so what that does is it takes A and it takes a divergence of the form. So I know we haven't discussed grad yet, but you have seen grad, so I don't feel too bad about it.
Sorry, why do we need a metric to define this object?
Sorry?
Why we need a metric to...
So two reasons. One, in order to get from a p-form to an n-minus p-form, think about it from our physicist's index perspective, we have to contract the p-indices with the epsilon symbol.
Yes.
And the epsilon symbol is downstairs, the form is downstairs, so we need a metric to raise the indices, if you like. Mm. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So... So it's kind of useful to see the forms in action, just because it's something that's familiar. So electromagnetism is most naturally described in the language of forms. So our gauge potential consists of the electrostatic potential and our vector potential. This is a one form, so we could write A as A mu dx mu. And then our field strength, the Maxwell tensor, F is simply dA. So that's just our field strength. So in components, it's just the anti-symmetrized partial derivatives of A. Now, if I've got my signs right, if I look at my stress tensor, I can sort of decompose it into electric and magnetic pieces. So my electric field, just reading off from here, is F naught I, which if I look at this definition is D naught AI minus DI A naught. And translating that into the vector calculus language, that's just, minus A dot minus grad phi. So that is indeed what the electric field is from Maxwell's electromagnetism. And then again, if you look at the components of B, you see that B is just curl A. But what's nice about this way of writing it is that you see that the Maxwell equations, well, half of them are just an identity. DF is zero because F is DA. So D squared is zero, therefore DF is zero. So this is just automatic, and that's half the Maxwell's equations. And then the other half are simply that delta F is whatever your source is. So delta F is that divergence, grad mu F mu, and that's going to be equal to whatever your source is. So Maxwell's equations have a very sort of concise representation in this language. Gauge invariance is also very easy to see because gauge invariance is simply saying that A goes to A plus D lambda. And so if A goes to A plus D lambda, F, which would go to D A plus D squared lambda, is simply D A, unchanged. So our gauge invariance is also straightforward. Now, one of the interesting things, which usually when you first do electromagnetism, the story stops there, is that if I imagine now that I don't just live in four dimensions, but let's be agnostic and say, well, okay, you know, what if I try and go beyond having a one-form gauge potential? So what if I took B as a gauge potential, where this is now a two-form? Why not? So that would then give me a field strength, H, which would be dB. So from the component perspective, this would just be given by appropriately commuted partial derivatives of B. And so that's just an example of a two-form. If I was in more, I mean, I could, if I was in more than four dimensions, I could go three, four, five, etc. forms. So how am I supposed to interpret these higher forms? Because although I can do this, I'd really like to have them mean something. So note that A mu couples point charges. So you have this notion, if you want to describe the Lagrangian or the action for a charged particle, Q, you kind of take this Lagrangian of Q, A mu, X dot mu. So that would be your Lagrangian for a charged particle. So what does B mu nu do? Kind of requires an additional index. So if this is my time here, this is some sort of time, then I can couple my B mu nu to a what we would call a world sheet. Because that is a world line. And so if I had some sort of coordinates here, t and x, then my coupling might be b mu nu, x dot mu, x prime nu. So that might be my Lagrangian for a charged linear object or string. So this means I can sort of associate A mu with a point object, B mu nu goes with a line charge, C mu nu lambda would be with a plane charge, etc. So we have this idea that we can construct extended objects with charges. So we don't just have to have point charges. So this might sometimes be called a zero brain. We call these objects brains. one brain or string, and this one would be a two brain or a wall, or membrane. And so we find actually when we start looking at gravity from a more general perspective and we start being more fluid about how many dimensions we've got, we sort of see that we can have extended objects that are charged under some of these form fields. So these typically, when you look at low energy string gravity, you sort of find a lot of these objects floating around. So obviously a line charge, you expect to find a B mu nu because your fundamental string is charged under a B mu nu field. But you can also have additional other form fields which give you brains. So the brains are called such, essentially coming from membrane. So it's sort of a derivative of the word membrane. So that's really what I wanted to say about forms, but I'd like to sort of look forward to tomorrow's lecture or cover some of the concepts now by thinking a little bit about a different way that you can anti-symmetrize derivatives. So tomorrow we'll look at the Lie derivative sort of more completely, but let's just look at another way of anti-symmetrizing. Remember that when we have a vector, we defined our vector as an operator acting on C infinity of M. So at a point, T acting on F was df by dt at P. And if we have a vector field in some neighborhood of P, then we can think about rdf by dt being associated at all the points in that neighborhood. So what happens if I've got another vector S? I could also take S acting on F, or indeed, I could construct a function which was a member of C infinity of M, which was locally df dt at all the points in some neighborhood of P. And then I can act on that new function with S. So I'm imagining I've got two independent vector fields, S and T, which are defined in some neighborhood of P. Then T, if I think about T, defines me a new function. Which I'm thinking about just taking df by dt at all points in the neighborhood of P. And similarly, I've got df by ds as another function, So now I can imagine taking a commutator. I could imagine taking ST minus TS acting on F. So this is like saying I've got d by ds of df dt minus d by dt of df ds. So what does that look like? So if I go step from the geometric expression to the coordinate expression, so s is just s mu d by dx mu, and that is acting on tf. And then I subtract So you might initially have thought, hang on, if I'm taking d by ds of df by dt or d by dt of df by ds, surely that process is commutative because it's just differentiation with respect to t and s. Well, it's not quite true because the t and s are, of course, coming from ordered derivatives along the curves, right? So they have a notion of the geometry going along with them. And as soon as I write it in this format, you see this t mu sitting in there. So if I follow this thought through, if I now look at what I get, this term, S mu T nu, because the partial differentiation is commutative, this term cancels with that one. And here you can see df by dx nu is a common factor. And so what I get is f is a derivative of t along s minus a derivative of s along t times df by dx. New. So what I notice now is that this is just some component, some new component of a vector times d by dx nu of f. So I'm going to call this vector st, I'm just going to call it a bracket, nu, d by dx nu of f. So now I've written that in the format of components of a vector times the basis vector element, c by dx nu, acting on f. And you see that that expression doesn't care what f is. So that is going to be true for all functions in C infinity of m. So this ST is a vector, and this is called the Lie bracket of S and T. So it's a commutator, it's sort of literally a commutator, of two vectors, yet it's also a derivative, similarly, in the sense that it's looking at derivatives of t along s and s along t. Again, going back to that dodgy expression that I wrote on that board at the end of yesterday's lecture. Why is this okay? It's because you've got the anti-symmetry again. So the only question that kind of remains is, do we have something like this that works on something other than a vector, like a covector or a tensor? And if so, what, you know, how is this the derivative of T along S or S along T? So those are the questions that we kind of have to decide. Just use the last few minutes to set up a little bit of formalism that we'll need tomorrow, and that is to talk about maps between manifolds. So I know you've already kind of met the notion of a diffeomorphism, but let's kind of build this up from a slightly more general perspective, because we'll sort of need some of the associated definitions. So if, let's look at our general picture, in general, if we have a manifold M, which is going to have dimension little m, and another manifold N, which is going to have dimension m, then I can imagine mapping from M to N. Now, the dimensionalities don't have to be the same. For example, our good old trusty sphere in three dimensions, this is an example where we map a two-dimensional manifold, which is the surface of the sphere, into three-dimensional space. So that's an example of a map that is into, it's an embedding. But we could also project down. So we can imagine taking our, you know, all the time we actually project, whenever we look at an image, we've kind of projected something down from three dimensions into two. So we also go from higher to lower dimensions in this process. And there we have this notion of somehow reducing the picture, but so, or projecting degrees of freedom out. So here we have some x's which go into R to the M. And here we've got a coordinate chart, the Y's, which go into R to the N. And so if we have a map from M to N, we can then kind of just lower it down and get a corresponding map, which I'll call F primed, which maps R to the M into R to the N. So we obviously now the story is we're going to use what we know about our maps, our structure, our differential structure on these two flat spaces to lift up and tell us something about what's going on in our manifolds. And what we want to do is we want to be able to transport vectors or covectors across from one manifold to the other. So the question is, what can we transport and from where? So what you've already seen, of course, is that if the two dimensions are the same, dim m is the same as dim n, and f is 1 to 1 and on to and C infinity, etc., etc. Then F is a diffeomorphism. And we simply regard, we don't really make the distinction between M and N. We sort of regard them as being the same. So if we have this map between the manifolds, if we have this F, we can actually construct a map one way of the tangent space and in the reverse direction of the cotangent space. I just want to introduce these before stopping. So the first one, the push forward, as it's called, let me assume that I've got a point P in M, a point Q in N, and I'm kind of looking at some neighborhood of each of these two points. P maps to Q under F. So P maps to Q. So here I'm imagining in my manifold, I've got a curve, my point P, and I've got a curve gamma. F takes this to N, where I've got my point Q, and a curve gamma primed. So because F goes forward from M to N, N down, then if I have a curve gamma in M, I've got an image curve gamma primed in N. I've got a parametrization T in M, so that gives me a parametrization T in N. And therefore, when I take d by dt, the operator, the tangent to that curve, I get a vector. So that's all extremely straightforward. So I can map vectors in M onto vectors in N. It doesn't mean, of course, that the tangent space in M will fill the whole tangent space in N if the dimensionality of M is less than N, but it will be some subspace of the tangent space. Again, our two sphere, the tangent plane of the North Pole, is simply some sheet of paper. It's two-dimensional of the two sphere, and we see that as a two-dimensional surface in three-dimensional space. It's a subspace of R cubed. And then the other map, unsurprisingly, is going to be taking us from covectors in N to covectors in M. So it goes the other way. So this one's called the pullback. What that's basically doing is saying, well, a member of the dual space at Q in N is a map from vectors in N into the reals. But we've, for a vector in N, we know we kind of have a pre-image in M, so we can sort of think of that as giving us an associated map from vectors in M down to the reals. So let me write it down what it is first. So here we're imagining if this is our M, our N, and the reals lying underneath. Here's our Q, our P. So a covector, so our vector here in M, S, maps to, via the push forward, some vector here, which is T, or F star of S. And then I take an element omega here, I simply map this into the real. So my omega star, this thing here, is F star of omega. So it gives me a way of taking this omega and associate, sort of, I get a map from vectors here down to the reals. So that's how I pull back the structure. Now that doesn't require the two dimensions to be the same, it doesn't require it to be a diffeomorphism, but if they're not the same, you can only push forward vectors and only pull back covectors. Obviously, if you have a diffeomorphism, where you don't care, you can go forward, you can go backwards, then you can push forward, you can pull back both vectors and covectors, because you can go in both directions. Okay.